This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So during Ango, we each month practice Fusatsu, which is a renewal of vows. And it's appropriate for those who have taken formal vows, bodhisattva vows, ordination vows, but also for every practitioner who is entering into the Buddha Dharma path, which is a path of vow. And so even before taking vows, we are introduced to them, experiencing their expression and living, beginning to live and practice within the influence of vows, even before we've formally taken them. It's like a steam bath in here. My glasses are falling up. Last few days of summer. And so Fusatsu is, in the Zen tradition, a renewal of vows, and it harkens back to the time of the Buddha when the Sangha would gather, the ordained Sangha would gather regularly to review and renew their commitment to their own monastic vows. So gave them a chance to take responsibility if they had wandered away from any of those vows, for the Sangha to acknowledge that and, in a sense, and to atone and to, in a sense, cleanse and purify the Sangha, and so that they could together as a community practice straightforwardly. And so on this path, we're this Ango concentrating on the Bodhisattva, on Bodhisattva, which is a path that is dedicated to ending suffering in all of its forms. And we come into practice being familiar with many of its expressions on a more gross level, more obvious level of suffering, but there are many subtle forms of suffering, of dukkha, that the Buddha recognized and taught, and that takes time to really see more clearly. And so all of these, though, have the effect of binding, of obscuring, of causing hurt. They negate, in a sense, negate our basic nature. They can destroy. And so we practice these obscurations so that we can free ourselves and live rather within compassion and clear wisdom and loving kindness and non-discriminating consciousness, patience, and so on. Avalokiteshvara, doing deep prajnaparamita, saw emptiness of the five conditions of the skandhas, and thus was relieved from misfortune and pain. The Buddha said, suffering is, in short, the skandhas, which incline towards attachment. The skandhas are the ways in which the self comes into being. And the Buddha and all the successive practitioners and teachers and enlightened beings down to the present time, each in their own age, in their own time, lived in times of war and peace, in times of famine and abundance, of plague and good health, of prosperity and poverty. And throughout it all, Buddhism has never denied those realities, those adversities, those results of dukkha. But rather have constantly pointed to the source of all of that suffering, which is the mind. In the Bodhisattva path, bodhicitta, the way-seeking mind, the mind that seeks, the thought that seeks enlightenment, citta, mind and thought, is extremely important, is missing the mark. There really is no bodhisattva path but for the bodhicitta. They are the same. And the expression, the real expression of bodhicitta is in a sense a very developed, a very mature expression of one's, of a practitioner's motivation. Most of us do not come in to practice. I would dare say very few come into practice with bodhicitta really functioning yet. Because the bodhicitta is the aspiration and the dedication to enlightenment for self and other, the alleviation, the ultimate liberation of suffering for self and other. So for most of us, this begins, this our motivation begins where we are, right? And in a sense, then through practicing and engaging the bodhisattva path and the teachings and reflecting on and practicing bodhicitta, because it can be practiced, if we continue, we will begin to have that, in a sense, enter into us. We will begin to realize, become larger and larger in our aspiration, and realize that in the beginning, it might have been very sincere, but it was too small. And so we can think of our motivation, which is all important in this path, because it is a path. And if we're not clear on what our motivation is, then we will run into obstacles, no doubt about it. And it will be very difficult to find our way through those, because we will not be clear about or will forget why we're there in the first place. We will not be inclined to look at that time, that event, that situation, in terms of the Dharma. We will tend to revert back to our normal ways of trying to solve problems, which is just, in a sense, rearrange things. Escape, avoid, destroy. And so we can think of motivation in terms of what we are moving away from. And we might think of aspiration as what we're moving towards. And this is just a way of looking at things. So if we think of it that way, then motivation can be our desire to move away from or begin to live more freely, more free of dukkha, of all of those forms of subtle and gross suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction. So there might be moving away from our sense of pain or isolation and wanting to move towards pleasure, true peace. And so in terms of examining our own motivation, what is behind us? It's sort of like motivation can be a sense of behind us, pushing us, compelling us to move forward. There's something there, right, that we're trying to free ourselves of, escape from in the true sense, break the cycle of. What is that pain, that disappointment, that dis-ease, that lack of fulfillment or confusion, the sort of more existential heartbreak? And then we can think of our aspirations, what we're trying to move towards. And this is where, you know, and from this point of view, motivation is what we already know. It's what we're in. We're experiencing it. We taste it. We feel it. It's not abstract. Aspiration can be more dependent upon this incredible power of the mind to imagine, to conceive before knowing, to hold in our mind or have a sense of something before we've actually experienced it, that there is something there, there's something possible. And in that way, aspiration is by its very nature larger than the awareness of where we're standing. And so it's not just trying to move away from, get away from this square of discomfort to a different square, but it's trying to break free of the squares altogether. And so what is it that you're moving towards? What illumination, what realization, what clarity, what embodiment? What is it that you want to know? What is it that you want to reclaim in this life, in this life, as your birthright? And so following this, way of thinking, we can look at practice and training as also moving, sort of working with those two motivations. One, more the motivation which is trying to free us of what is binding, and training that is aspirational, which is sort of stimulating or feeding or affirming or helping to clarify that which we sense or conceive of as possible. I was thinking of this in terms of the 10 values of the Beyond Fear of Differences work, in terms of reverence and authenticity. And if we think of authenticity as an aspect of Buddha nature, it's your basic nature. In other words, you don't create authenticity. Authenticity appears when we stop contriving. We stop trying to be something. And we can think of reverence as more the relative, as the warmth, the life, the blood that flows through that authenticity, which brings us into intimate contact with what's real, which is another way of saying what's sacred. So if we think of reverence as a deep respect, a profound respect for our own and each other's humanity, which has to include our delusion, right? We can't leave that out. And by respect, I don't mean a worshiping of or a, you know, perpetuation of, but a respect for its power, a respect for its creation. A lot of work has gone into creating delusion. And a respect for its ability to transform our lives. To have reverence, to love, to have respect for life, for creatures, for people. And so if we take this into Fusatsu, we begin by bowing to the Buddha, which in a sense, and this is just a way of looking at these, it's nothing definitive, we can think of bowing as a kind of aspirational practice, leaping into the body of the Buddha, leaping into an identity with Buddha, with enlightened nature, with Buddha nature. A bow is not an intellectual thing. It's not a contrivance. It's something that is manifesting our deepest nature. Why is it that bows in their various forms appear all over the world in different cultures, different traditions? What's that about? What the prostration is with something we already know, and it's an expression, leaping into the body and mind, breath, the heart of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Bodhidharma said, worship, which is really synonymous with reverence. Worship means reverence and humility. Revering your true nature, respecting your true nature. And humbling our delusions. Reverence and humility. He goes on to say, the Buddha wanted students, us, you, me, to consider worship as humility and calming the mind. To have reverence is to be humble. It's not proud, it's not arrogant, it's not aggressive, but it's also not ambivalent, it's not reticent. There's a confidence in this with the humility, and it is a calming of the mind. Bodhidharma says, so he encouraged us to prostrate our bodies to show our reverence. How do we show it? How do we express it? How do we express it before we've actually made contact with it? Right? When I first came into training, if and when my teacher talked about reverence, I probably didn't hear much of that. It was not part of my lexicon. It wasn't part of my language. It wasn't that I didn't know it, didn't relate to that in some ways. But it wasn't clear. And perhaps many of us have some relationship with that. And so when we come into practice, rather than explaining it, right, how far is that going to go? We bow. We manifest it. Before we even know it, we're bringing it to life before we even understand what we're doing. So the Buddha encouraged us to prostrate our bodies, to show our reverence, and to let the internal express, to let the external express the internal, to harmonize essence and form. It's like working from the outside in. The inside is not yet developed. We don't yet understand. We have not yet made full conscious contact with so many of these aspects. And of course, that varies person to person. But so it's in a way, it's very skillful to work from the outside. Do this with your body. Bow. Gassho. Serve. Let the external express the internal. And then as we do that, they start to come together. We begin to experience something internally that is connected to what is happening externally, and they begin to harmonize. So it's a kind of leaping forth into reverence, into our true nature. You know, there's so many ways in which Dharma practice kind of sneaks up on you. You know. Like a good friend. But you could say, well, why don't we just leap? Why don't we just, you know, sidestep all this business? Just leap. Be my guest. Do, by all means, just leap. And if you find, as most do, that that's not so easy. What does that even mean? We see that we carry the weight of these years, years, years of our habits, our ideas, our assumptions, projections. And you know, Buddhism says this over and over, and we hear it, but do we really hear it? In a sense, we can't really hear it until we begin to see it, feel the weight, experience it again, again, deeper and deeper, more and more broadly. Then we realize, oh, this is what you've been talking about. Bodhidharma said, those who concentrate on the outer expression, the form, but fail to cultivate the inner meaning, won't stop indulging their delusion, hatred, and fear, but will exhaust themselves. And that's why he emphasizes, and we emphasize, and the teachings emphasize, the mind of your prostration, the mind of your sitting, the mind of your walking. Because otherwise, there is no cultivation. There's just a gesture. While everything else is just continuing on as before. And that inner part, is completely up to you. It is completely up to you and me. Me for me, you for you. That happens within the solitude and the chamber of your mind. In a sense, you decide. You choose where you're going to put your attention, how you're going to engage. And I think that too takes a long time to actually get it. To actually get that. Reverence and humility are ways of talking about compassion. And in this, it brings us to authenticity, that harmonizing of inner and outer is reclaiming our authenticity. One body, one mind, one practice, one awareness, one dharma, one aspiration. to truly be connected in the Ten Values, it says to truly be connected with our emotions, our expressions, our experiences, and those of others. To truly be connected, intimate contact. And so we begin, after the prostrations, we begin with the Gatha of Atonement, which in a sense is turning towards that which is motivating us, all evil karma ever created by me since of old. And so speaking on behalf of practitioners, in that first line, I recognize I have acted in ways that have hurt others and myself. I carry the regret and the sadness of those actions, the disappointment in myself, the pain of having hurt others. I wish I could take them back. I wish I had acted differently. But I didn't, and I can't. That's a very powerful motivation if we want to free ourselves, if we want to correct that path, if we want to live differently. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, based in the state of mind, the state of my emotions, my body, I made choices. I succumbed, I gave way, I took on certain desires, and I put those above someone else's well-being. I let those be more important. And by being led by unhealthy desires, I lost my reverence. I got lost in my respect, my appreciation, my love for myself and for you, for others. I allowed that reverence, that respect, to be less important than what I wanted. And being led that way, I became distant from my authenticity, disconnected. Born in my body, mouth, and thought, I acted, I spoke, I harbored thoughts, I developed those. I had images in my mind. I gave them power. I gave them truth, validity. Now I atone for them all. I reclaim my reverence. I return to my authenticity. I step back into my powers of hearing. I align myself with the Dharma. I bring it to mind. I reflect on it. I examine karma, cause and effect, my actions and their consequences. How many of those consequences were not what I wanted? How much of the consequences of my action leapt out of my control? What do I need to learn from this? And now I can align myself once again with my intentions, renew that, restore that. Now my mind becomes more clear. My mindfulness becomes more settled. My body feels more at ease, not so distressed. It can relax. I can be aware again. I'm no longer in conflict with myself, or not as much, because this is a practice. And sometimes it takes time. I recognize I can fall. I can fail. I can hurt you. I can disappoint myself. I can be deluded. I can be selfish. I have been all of those things. I have done all of those things. And those actions and their consequences are my responsibility, but they are not me. They do not define me if I do not define myself by them. And the consequences of those actions do not end until I end them. Am I ready to end them? And so then we chant Namu, past seven Buddhas, Namu Shakyamuni Buddha. Manjushri, Samantabhadra, Avalokiteshvara, all of these bodhisattvas and buddhas. In chanting Namu, we're paying homage, we're prostrating, we're expressing our reverence, our respect. To who? To what? For some, to living beings, for having lived their lives the way they did. We bow to the Buddha. Thank you for living your life the way you did. Thank you for leaving home, for searching, for persevering, for being, for your dedication, and then for teaching. You didn't have to do that, and you did. Reverence to Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, these bodhisattvas of wisdom and compassion who present themselves in a perfected form so that our aspiration is large. These Buddhas and bodhisattvas appear as enlightened, compassionate beings because they walk this path, because they too fell, failed, hurt, disappointed, traveled the path from samsara, from delusion, to their enlightenment. And they were not defined, they were not defeated, they were not discouraged too long. And because they contain the whole of human possibility, we do. They lived within their vows. So when we're turning towards these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, let them be living. They are living. Otherwise, how can they provide examples? And they live in your mind. Create relationships with these beings so they can be an example. And recognize that when you do that, you're doing that with yourself. You're doing that with all beings. And recognize that they live within their vows. And then aspire to do the same. To transcend the dualities ultimately so that we're no longer, it's no longer about being pushed from behind and being pulled from ahead. It's just the path. And so then we chant the four vows. I vow to alleviate the suffering, to be free of desires, to never stop studying the Dharma, and to attain what cannot be attained. And in each of those vows, there is the grounded, being grounded in the reality. Sentient beings are numberless, desires are inexhaustible. Dharmas are boundless. Buddha way is unattainable. And then there's the aspiration. I vow to put an end to that suffering, to free myself of the desires, and so on. And then we end with the three treasures, being one with the Buddha. Aspire to awaken, liberate your basic nature. Aspire to be Buddha. And then we chant with all sentient beings, raise the Bodhi mind, let the supreme way be realized. Let that be your motivation. Let that be your practice. Raise that Bodhi mind again and again and again every day. Being one with the Dharma, to align our pores, our cells, our energy, our winds, our fluids with the Dharma, with what is true. And to want to see, to live in a world that is sacred, that has, that is dignified, that is blessed, that is beautiful, that is whole. And do that with all sentient beings, penetrating all sutras, letting wisdom be like the ocean. Study, 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 examine, 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 practice, practice, practice. Being one with the Sangha. When we let go of the self, we realize the self of self and others are clouds passing. Our profound solitude, we realize, includes everyone. Everyone has dignity, has wealth, has brightness. And do that with all sentient beings. Lead the people. Let harmony pervade everywhere. Affirm this life. Be giving. Be truthful. See the perfection. Practice your anger. Give up our greediness. Be a sincere student. Live your aspiration. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to have a great aspiration. An aspiration is not, it takes chutzpah, right? It takes, you gotta, you can't just dilly-dally about this thing. You gotta put your ass on the line. That's what an aspiration, that's what a vow is. You know, in Jikai, will you maintain this? Pretty much. As best I can, when I'm able. No. Yes, I will. Let the external harmonize with the internal. Yes, I will. Does that mean that person is doing it every moment? Of course not. That's why they say, yes, I will. So that they can hear themselves saying that, this is what I'm going to do. Because I'm not going to always do it. And so I need to say this, and I need to hear myself saying it, and I need to say it again and again. And I need you to hear me say it. There is no failure in this. There's no failure of an aspiration. It's of a different realm. We can break promises. We can turn away from aspirations, but you can't fail them. They're not like that. So, may the merits of maintaining the precepts permeate the Dharma world, and may our sincere vows to accomplish the Buddha way be realized together. You know, we end every service with that. Echo. That's the Bodhisattva vow. May we realize our vows to realize the Buddha way together, self and other. Every service is dedicated to that. And it all arises from your basic, what we're calling motivation, the life force. And so we have to really get clear about that. We have to work at that. We have to understand it. We have to allow ourselves to know what's important in this life. And one of the very important functions of a monastery and training is to give you enough space in your mind and in your body to reflect on that deeply. Because once you walk out of here, there are going to be 100 billion voices and forces trying to get at you and tell you what's important. Fortunately, some of them are true. But there's a whole host of them that have a whole different agenda. If we do not know, it is at least very difficult, if not impossible, to stay on a true path. We will get lost and not know that we're lost. We will become overly concerned about things that are not actually what we should be concerned about. And so as we begin this Sangha, as we were beginning this Sangha, I thought this is a good place to begin, to really be thinking about this. It's very private in a certain sense. It's very private. It's something you do within the quiet of yourself. And it's not a fixed thing. It's a constantly evolving thing. It really brings us to the miraculous of what it is to be a human being. There's nothing measurable about this. You can't put it on a graph. It requires faith. But when you feel it, when you are inside of it, you know its power. You know its power. And the more you know that power, the more you are committed to protecting that, because you realize how essential that is. And that's something we can also do for each other.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.